This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We have a poet here who teaches at Montgomery College. She is preserving literary history in Washington, D.C. Her name is Joanna Howard, but more than everything she's done, she's a writer. So here's the poet, and here's the poem.
This is a poem that I wrote at St. Mary's many, many years ago. The peacock reveals tricks of the creative process and more. He greets me at the stair top, a process of feather and grace. Watch me, he purrs. I'll show you how it's done. Like a Las Vegas showgirl, he balances each step, weighs his burden, reaches the landing, and, turning, deals a fan of feathers, shuffling shag, revealing blues, blending emeralds, an audience of eyes. From where I stand, all I've seen is his backside, how it's done by this plump rumple of a bird with white-black underwings which he scratches on days off while practicing, mending, mulling, feather-stretching, perfecting. Again, he pivots, eyeing me. I know. I've seen how he does it, this brilliant cakewalk of life. What it takes to balance wing and feather, to preen and repair, to sweat magic.
Joanna Howard is here, and I know exactly the scene she's painted for us. That is St. Mary's College in Southern Maryland. And
yes.
Tell us about those peacocks.
Oh, my goodness. The peacocks, which I had never had any up-close and personal encounters until I went to St. Mary's, are beautiful animals, beautiful birds. They sound crazy,
yeah.
And they're very friendly. They're friendly kind of in a pushy, I wanted you to do my bidding kind of way.
They used to walk the halls when I was teaching there. And they have a call, which is quite ugly, actually, a
yes.
screech. So you were there for the poetry festivals.
I went to a couple of poetry festivals, and I also took a class with you and Michael Glaser.
Right, at 90s or something.
Yes.
Yes, so Joanna Howard is a teacher, and I'm very interested in the fact that you are immersed in poetry on many levels. So in the classroom, mm-hmm. when the semester ends, this time, what do you wish that they would take away? What would you say is the one thing they would think about from your class?
I would say patience with revision.
How do you teach that?
Well, by saying in so many different ways that something is not finished with a single draft, which I'm sure that there are many single draft poets out there who are brilliant and able to, you know, strike lightning with the first draft. But any kind of writing involves a certain amount of planning, drafting, revising, because with each revision, you're looking at your poem or your piece of writing in a different way, whether it's a way that someone has told you to try or suggested you try, or just simply the nature of having another version of what you began with.
So they'll remember you for that.
I hope
when they're
so.
When they're sitting in their garrets in 20 years
uh-huh.
and writing their great tome,
mm-hmm.
they'll say, you know what? Let me go back. Let me go back. Let me go back. There are lumps under this mattress. And they'll attribute that to you. So you think that was your main point in teaching? A main point?
A main point? Yes. The juice of the paper is in the revision.
Okay. I want everyone to do that right now. And we're all about your revisions. So read us a couple of poems side by side,
mm-hmm.
and we'll get an idea of who Joanna Howard is. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Okay. I have twin poems, or poems that are part of a couple. I hope someday to make it a series, but it's based on my genealogical research. And about 20 years ago, I found out that I have English ancestry. I also have Irish ancestry, and I was surprised to see that I had English ancestry. And those English ancestors went to Ireland during the 1600s, late 1500s, 1600s, and pretty much did their best to decimate the culture as well as the people in Ireland. I have a quote here from something that I was reading online, and I don't have the source, so forgive me, but it's a quote that says, "No masterless men, including bards and rhymers, would be allowed to live in the area under his rule." And this refers to one of my ancestors, Francis Cosby, who with his son Alexander were part of a lot of horrific stuff. So I wrote this first poem about a massacre at Mully Mast. And it's a very straightforward poem. Maybe someday it'll be prose, but here goes. O'Moore, Hartpole, Harrington, and Cosby invited the sept to talk peace and tea at Mully Mast, not mentioning massacre until the fort doors were bolted in the ring fort before the blood holes ran 20 feet deep. For Cosby, it was all in a day's work. Irish dangling from his sallow tree always humored him at the end of a long day. Children hung from their mother's hair like scarves tied a little too snugly. These crucifixions in Queen's County made up for the times he was bound to a tree. So that's the first poem.
Mully Mast is someplace in Ireland.
Yes, it's in Laois County, which is south of Dublin.
And he was tied to a tree?
Yes, that was one of the ways they got back with him. They tied him to a tree at one time.
And then what?
They left him.
And that isn't very funny.
Well, but, you know, considering that he had just led a massacre where he killed a great many Irish folk by bringing everybody under the pretense of having a tea to talk about peace.
What era was this? What year, I wonder?
This was in the late 1500s or very early 1600s. Mm-hmm. It was during the plantation era in Ireland. And so again, this is what actually happened.
How did you know this?
Just by doing genealogical research and researching the family.
Were you surprised?
To be related to them?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't thrilled. But his connection to poetry is that his wife, Dorcas Sidney, is a cousin of Philip Sidney. So I had a few years of wandering around feeling just darn proud to be related to Philip Sidney.
Who is?
A great English poet. But then, once I started researching the Cosby family, I started to think, well, maybe there are a few poems in this that I need to process through.
And what is the sister poem to this?
The sister poem is more abstract, and it's about the experience of being Cosby and tied to the tree. I figured that if the masterless men, the bards and rhymers, were being executed and exterminated, then I wanted to give them a moment in time to take some revenge on this. So this one is called The Laughing Tongues of Mully Mast. Those Irish tongues, so nimble and long, licked and lashed me to a tree, pinning my arms to my side, winding around my ankles, wagging my worth to the wind. Those tongues spit lies about me. They slid beneath my skin and pressed my pain like a toothache. They sang my defeat in slippery Celtic cadences. They whispered tales of monsters returning at night.
Wagging my worth to the wind. Mm-hmm. You have quite a background there, but you've overcome it beautifully. So I would like you to tell us a little bit about your process. We'll unravel one at the end, but when do you write? You're a full-time professor. You are in charge of many big events. How have you found a room of your own?
Yes, and it's between my ears, and it goes with me. I have to say, it's in my cell phone. But I find that ideas come to me from all over the place, from current events and so forth, and I write them down in my notebook. And sometimes something will be pushing so hard I have to write a poem about it. But other times, and I think this is where being a full-time writing instructor comes into play, I just don't have the energy or the time.
Let's hear one more poem.
Okay. This is a poem that was revised. It was one that I wrote at the invitation of Wing Chi Chan, and you were there too, for the commemoration and remembrance of the rape of Nanking. I wrote a much longer poem, and then I knew as I read it I wanted to revise it, so I revised it over a few years, and now it's coming out in Sligo Journal.
I just love that quality you have. It's revising is like a holy grail, but let's hear it.
Okay. It's called Listen to the Martyrs, and it's for Iris Chang. Before we choose violence, bring to mind Nanking. Photographs of heads arranged in haunting conversations, a lone baby on a train yard's splintered track, a newsreel of one old man remembering his nursing mother, blood pouring from her wounds toward his brother, too young to grasp anything but a slack breast. Today, we would like to see ourselves saints, wrapped in soothing robes of righteousness, padding peaceably toward enlightenment in the raked sandbox of our spiritual retreat. Yet, a pebble in our sandal troubles us. Are we the Nazi who saved thousands of Chinese, or the ones who slaughtered millions of Jews? Mm. Are we the American Japanese interned in camps, or the Japanese soldier decapitating children?
Mm-hmm.
Let us sit in this confusion. Let us hold it in our hearts. Inhale the names of the thousands crying forgotten in their graves. Exhale a vow of memory to never forget what happened, to never let it happen again. Before we choose violence, bring to mind Nanking.
Let us hold it in our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
That's very beautiful. Iris Chang was a woman who chronicled this event.
Yes.
And apparently the only one who has really given us a historical take on that. So I'm so glad you... Did you attribute this to her, or did you put her in the poem? I forget where the name...
I dedicate this to her because, you know, she gave her life to do all of this research. I read both her book and I read her mother's biography of her. And it, in order to write this poem, that brings up another issue that I like about writing poetry. It's the amount of research. You know, with poets, when you're writing about something, you get to go and find out. This poem and the one that it is its parent poem are based on my researching this historical event, using YouTube videos, reading online, reading those two books. And
not
that's
everyone
what filtered.
Would be so fastidious, though. I mean, this is you. You're scholarly,
yes,
as well as an artist. And that gives us so many riches that are underneath the layers. For instance, when you say Sir Philip Sidney, mm-hmm, I mean, I know his poem Sylvia. And even if you don't, it doesn't matter. But you have layers of gold there. And mm-hmm, if someone happens to know one of those secrets, it's all the better for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Now, you do something which is going to make history and is going to be immortal, and that is the Splendid Wake. What is a Splendid Wake?
Well, a Splendid Wake is an organization that was begun by Myra Scleru and I think Elizaveta Ritchie and some others to record the history of D.C. poets and poetry. And by D.C., I mean visualizing the metro, the subway map. And if it's within that boundary, then it's part of our reach.
So we have the environs or the suburbs also.
Yes, and it's part of the, or housed with George Washington University in the Special Collections Program, which has, it's an archive of D.C. area writers, poets and fiction and so forth. They gave us the space to create a wiki where we have a list of every single poet and poetry movement and publishing house and so forth that we know of.
Extant, or just do you honor those who have been have gone on?
Oh, we honor those who have gone on, and we're an ongoing research project. I won't say that what we have is the last word. I don't think we've reached the last word yet. What we need more than anything are volunteers to help us upload information to the wiki, to do some research for some of the organizations.
Yeah, right now you're just the one. You do everything. And so although Myra started it, you have been truly the one in the trenches.
Well, can I just say thank you, first of all, because I never shy away from a compliment, but I'm not the only one in the trenches.
The purpose to begin with was to honor the deceased poets, right? Is that the way it began?
I am not certain about that. I think it was simply to start keeping a record of everything that has happened in the poetry world in D.C. since 1900.
That's huge. That is huge. We have had it's really a bedrock of poetry.
And absolutely.
It's ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you have events? What do you do to show the community what's happening?
Well, every year we have a program where, because we are a literary historical group, it's not a traditional reading or an open mic, but it's a presentation of two or three aspects of what we're collecting, whether it's remembering a specific poet. For instance, this year, Martin Murray is going to be doing a presentation on Walt Whitman.
Who spent a lot of time in D.C.
Yes, yes. And Sister Joy Alford is going to be talking about Sojourn and Purpose with poems of social conscience and spirituality. Diane Woods is going to talk about the Spirit First Meditation Poetry Contest. And Jacqueline Jules and Temple Cohn will be reading their winning poems for that. So that's just the flavor of this year's program.
Mm-hmm. And I know in the past I've seen hip-hop honored. I've seen different cultures highlighted. And I think every part of this area has been touched in some way or another. And you continue to do that.
And different ages, too. I mean, we've had PG County Poet Laureates, I'm sorry, Poet Ambassadors that are teenagers, and they came with Patrick Washington. And we like to do that. In general, we like to have a mix of different ages, different cultures to show what we're trying to record and retain.
An archive.
Mm-hmm.
So important to make permanent. Mm-hmm. But more than that, you are a poet. Joanna
yes.
Howard is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress, and she's going to read us a poem.
Okay. This poem is called Madness Upgrade 2017, and you'll hear in it, if you're any kind of English major, a lot of allusions and lines that I grew up with from favorite poems or stories, and it was written and revised in moments of great frustration. So here we go. No longer the paperback woman with electrified hair chained to an iron bedpost, her fingers tracing imagined patterns on the attic wallpaper, or a scientist in a banished lab creating monsters whose homemade looks strike nightmares and diary pages shared in therapy. These days, we don't have time to reflect. Circling the widening gyre takes too long and goes nowhere. Give us a meme instead. Something we can follow on Facebook. Short prose, vapid and snappy. For if you can write it, you can be it, says the grumpy cat. We chuckle, we scroll, we share what it means to be mad. Sometimes, IRL, we are shocked when someone, moving out of metaphor, snatches a baby, straps a bomb to its belly, hurls it into a bus full of school children, and watches the festival of reds and yellows and screams, flashing lights and floating legs. We pause. We feel the feels. We scroll. Is a momentary disruption of common sense, a passing meme, strong enough to trip the wires of critical thought? "Here, have some water. It'll give you cancer." And the cat grimaces at these words on his fur. We smile wryly. We scroll. Madness releases metaphor if only to shake us awake. It's beating your head with a wooden chair, and the chair breaks again. The emperor demands your new clothes, though you're wearing a shroud. It's the urge to kill a black man and claim you thought his saxophone was a gun.
Mm. There we go, a little surreality going on there.
Oh, yeah.
Let me tell you who she is. We already told you that she coordinates a splendid wake. Her poems have appeared in Mi Poesias, Barcelona, on Barcelona, Gargoyle. She has been in Whose Woods These Are, which is a journal of the WordWorks residents at the Joaquin Miller Cabin. She has done various iterations of the Poetry Month webpage, which was coordinated years ago. She's been featured on Mike Maggio's Poetry Month, was a finalist in Arlington Moving Words Program, has poems coming out in Sligo, as we said, and has been published as a narrative writer. And the title was Who Were You When Kennedy Was Shot? Past technology editor of the Potomac Review Literary Journal, and was guest editor of Poetry E-Magazine Truck. Do you have a poem that you could unravel for us and tell us where you were when you thought of it and how you arrived at the process?
Okay. This one, I was on Facebook when I began it. It's called Aftershock, and it was a discussion on Marilyn Callett's space. People were talking about where they were on September 11th, and I thought about it and thought about it, and then I thought about the people who had died on September 11th. You know, Marilyn had made the comment, "Trauma keeps us standing in the same place," and I thought, what about the trauma of being instantly dead when you weren't expecting it? So I started to think about this poem and wrote a few drafts, and then I sent it to Molly Fisk, who reads my poetry for me and sends me back tons of comments and so forth, because she was helping me find the shape of the poem. She suggested that I not punctuate any at the end of any line at all, ever. And so, because what I wanted to create was that kind of feeling that I would imagine someone might have, someone who's now a ghost or a spirit who's been instantly killed and hasn't had time to prepare. So this is what came up. And then after I revised it with Molly, I think I did a couple of line-by-line edits. So,
well, let's hear some part of this.
Okay. It's called Aftershock. Ghosts keep floating from the screen, though the television has been turned off, body after body, like laundry in the wind, protoplasm writhing in suits from Barney's, bleeding through chef jackets, outfits bought on sale at Goodwill, souls blasted out of their bodies, no time to catch a spiritual drop-down mask to lead the way to the other side. These ghosts shot from crumbled and burning legs, torsos ripped away from shoulders, brains smashed to mud. These souls cling to the warm electrons of last night's news, and the hand that should have written this poem hangs over a sheared slice of airplane somewhere in Arlington.
Well, I think it worked. And now we would like a final poem.
Okay. I'd like to go back to St. Mary's, and this is called Epitaph, Anne Wolsey Calvert. I apparently cut class on one of the days when I was working with you and Michael Glaser, but it's based on an exhibit they had where they managed to open up the grave of a woman and create a wax image of her and so forth. It just struck me as being so peculiar. But here we go. Epitaph, Anne Wolseley Calvert. Examination of the human remains has added considerably to our knowledge of health and disease in early Maryland. Exhibit narrative. Beneath moles and spent sunflower stalks, you decomposed in quiet anonymity until radar uncovered the lead, the argon, the wood, the bone, the thread of forgetting. Archaeologists, those yellow-hatted crustaceans, trussed a crossbeam pulley, hoisting you up and out from being to bone to artifact. They poked you like a flea market bargain, translating a jawbone into a blue-eyed bust encased in plexiglass, gazing at gamma ray images of your lead-shrouded skull. What can bones tell about a life? Of boiling magenta in August's cast iron heat, of fingering a rosary, Job's tears piercing flesh. Can we smell your memory of barn-dried tobacco or recall pigs trotting in your butterfly town? We like to think our lives are carved into time like a cathedral mnemonic, immortal, waiting, but like a tombstone engraving, time wears us away, flesh and fabric, nail and bone, released from future's prying fingers and minds that seek but do not know.
That is the voice of Joanna Howard. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support from the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.